Welcome back to License to Spiel. I'm Thad Haight.
I'm Carl Wonders.
And this week we are talking about the Bourne Identity. Wait, Carl, didn't we talk about this one already?
I can't remember. Sorry.
I get flashes of it, but I'm not like 100% sure.
Yeah, every once in a while, something that's very plot relevant will come to mind, but... No, I can't remember whose idea this was, but yeah.
I think it was mine. This is the 1988 TV miniseries, The Bourne Identity, which is based on the book, obviously not based on the movie that hadn't come out yet.
Correct.
And from what I have understand, from what I've read about it, it follows the book very closely, which the movie does not.
Although the first movie does, the first Matt Damon movie follows the books much more closely than the second and third ones, which take the title and that's about it.
Right.
It's been a while since I read the book, but this one is pretty faithful. I mean, they cut out a few things for dramatic reasons that I think are just frankly overcomplicating the story, and we can maybe talk about it when it comes up, but. For the most part, this is pretty much the story that Robert Ludlum wrote in the book. And he obviously wrote two more in the series. And, you know, when we get towards the end of the movie, we can talk, about some changes they made to wrap the story up in one movie versus three. I've seen this, I think, once way back when I was, you know, reading the book and Netflix was still mailing DVDs and they had this one.
Oh boy.
And I said, oh, I'll check this out. And I honestly remembered very little of it. I remembered Richard Chamberlain and Jacqueline Smith were in it. And I had forgotten there are a whole slew of that guys in this movie that we'll get to. This is very much a that guy's movie. What did you think of this?
It took a long time for me to get invested in it. But mm-hmm. once I did, I really enjoyed it. I think I was telling you earlier today that I was watching this last night, and it's a 3-hour thing. So I was not expecting to watch the whole thing last night, but getting around the point where I probably would have turned it off and watched the rest this morning, I started really getting into the story. So I stayed up until almost 1 a.m. watching this last night.
Yeah, I watched it in two chunks. I tried to get through because there's... The version we have it's a one long thing, but it still has the fades to black for the commercials. And the credits in the middle, the to be continued cliffhanger moment at the end of the first half.
And then that you see the scene again
when the
next one comes up.
You do the whole thing. the second part starts about 5 minutes before the first one ends. Yeah, it's no... last time on Star Trek, but you know,
and now the continuation.
Yeah, once you get over the fact that this isn't the story of the Matt Damon Bourne Identity, and it's not a wall-to-wall action movie, I'm with you. I didn't remember much of it, but I enjoyed it way more than I thought I remembered enjoying it. I guess when I watched it the first time, for whatever that's worth, it has its moments of this is a slightly cheesy, because they were all slightly cheesy in the 80s made for television movie. There are other parts though. I think for the most part I could have almost seen this be a theatrical release
from
the 80s. They spent a lot of money, I think, making this movie, at least on
certainly
locations.
Yeah,
I didn't see a lot of this is the back lot pretending to be the streets of Paris or anything. It seemed like they were actually in the locations that they were purported to be in the story for the most part.
Yeah,
I mean, for a 80s TV movie, there's a fair bit of violence that happens. I thought it was a really well put together film. I think I quibble with some of the acting choices at times, but I think it's also just the nature of the beast.
The music.
Yeah, it's something.
It is very much like they went to, like they didn't because it was the 80s, but it was like they went to royaltyfreesuspensemusic.com.
Yeah, it's very on the nose.
Thank you.
So the music was written by a guy named Lawrence Rosenthal. And if you look up his IMDb page, he wrote music for Clash of the Titans, the old Harry Hamlin version of the movie, the Ray Harryhausen movie. He wrote music for the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles from the 90s. And he wrote a ton of made-for-TV movies. Like every other, at least I would say 80% of his credits on IMDb are made-for-TV movies. This movie won an Emmy for Best Score. For
Slim Pickens, you know, in 1988, I guess.
It must have been. Yeah, it's something.
I mean, Star Trek TNG was on in 1988, and it had better music than this. Just saying.
Well, I should have been more specific. It won an Emmy for miniseries / TV made for TV movie.
Okay, off the top of my head, I do not know what other miniseries came out in 1988, but now I'm gonna look it up because I need Born Identity One. I mean, I haven't seen any of these others, so I couldn't tell you.
Okay.
I don't know. Have you seen Perry Mason, The Case of the Avenging Ace?
Nope.
Or Napoleon and Josephine, A Love Story?
Nope.
Two Hallmark Hall of Fame movies made it, though. April Morning and Foxfire.
Wow.
And I couldn't tell you whether those have good scores or not. So I don't know. And yeah, and looking at the best miniseries category or outstanding drama comedy special, I haven't seen any of those either. So, OK, it's possible there just weren't any good miniseries scores that year.
Or they weren't doing it. I mean, if you listen to music from television of the 80s, for the most part, it's pretty it's not very sophisticated. It's certainly not what we get
with now
TV scores today. It's funny. They specifically gave this to part one and not part two. I guess
I'm pretty sure they had the same music.
Well, yes. But anyway, yeah. So that is the only award it received, although Richard Chamberlain was nominated for a Golden Globe. He did not win.
OK. I mean, he did a good job.
Yeah. Yeah, and he was well known for doing these types of TV movies. He was in a show called Dr. Kildare for a long time. That's really where he became famous. And
I have heard of that.
Yeah. And then he did a whole bunch of miniseries. He was all over television for a long time. Also in The Three Musketeers in 1973, he played Aramis.
And he's still alive.
He is still alive, yeah.
Because when watching a movie like this, especially a movie like this where so many of the actors are older, even in this, I'm like looking at IMDb, oh, this guy's dead, this guy's dead, this guy's dead.
Yeah,
really had that feeling. Total aside, but the other night when I watched the movie 12 O'Clock High from 1949,
yes,
I'm pretty sure I checked all of them. I think they're all dead.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Even the really young people in that movie.
I was like, oh, well, maybe that like young sergeant that keeps going back and forth between sergeant and private is like, no, he was in his 30s in this movie. Never mind.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. So this movie basically, I mean, the setup is exactly the same as the Matt Damon film. Man falls in the water. In this case, he washes ashore rather than is picked up by a boat. And he is taken to Marcus Brody. Who is living Denham Elliott.
Yeah. When I was watching that, I texted you. I'm like, hey, it's Marcus Brody.
Yeah. It's a good role for him. Mm-hmm. I like his character in this movie.
Yeah. I thought it was weird that the people who took him to the doctor's house just left him on the porch and walked away without the doctor, before the doctor had even come to the door.
The people in this town are weird. I mean, they have this gaggle of kids that follow him around. The creepy kids, like he's suddenly in a Disney movie.
Well, see, they don't have commercials, you see.
Oh, maybe. That's true. They do say said. That. Yeah.
They don't have commercials, so they have to find their entertainment somewhere else.
Watch you having a fit in your sleep. I like the line. He wakes up and asks him where he is. And the guy's like, I was hoping you'd be British.
Yeah,
I thought was a fun line. You know, the setup is basically the same. It's not as modern. He has a piece of microfiche in his hip rather than a little laser pointer with the bank number on it. But I mean, other than that, it's essentially the same.
And I assume it was microfiche in the book.
I think so, yeah. Microfilm of some kind. Yeah. You know, doesn't know who he is. He's having these weird dreams.
And he can field strip a pistol.
He can.
Bullet holes, and we find out plastic surgery. His face has been altered.
Yes.
Which comes back later.
It does.
And even though, you know, when that comes back, I had obviously remembered that line from 2 hours before, but like, that's still, when we find out that he's not really Jason Bourne, that part still just like really surprised me. I was not expecting that.
Yeah. Yeah. The Bourne identity is has a different meaning in this story than just in the Matt Damon version. Yeah, it's an interesting idea, and I had kind of forgotten that part of the book and the story just because it had been so long that we find out that Jason Bourne was a person who is not the person we were watching in this movie. I thought I liked the line, another line that kind of led a little bit of authenticity, I think, was when Brody, I'm going to call Marcus Brody, when Washburn, the doctor, they're walking on the beach and he says that he found the bullet holes and everything, and Bourne's first inclination to say, oh, I was in the war. And he says, well, you were stitched up way better than the doctors in the field would have done, which I thought was not something I thought of, but it kind of rings true. Like, you wouldn't look that good if you were shot up in a war. At some point, they run across some guys who I guess were part of the gang that attacked him in the first place. You know, he's recognized, and that's why. And then the doctor says he has to leave, and apparently he knows people who can forge passports and stuff, which is awfully convenient.
You don't have a passport forger guy?
I don't. I should work on that.
I'll have to introduce you to mine.
Oh, okay.
Everybody needs to be able to know how to forge a passport.
Yeah. All right. I was just skimming through the movie and I came across the scene where he pulls the microfiche out of his hip.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from a few moments of, you know, cheesy 80s fake blood, I think the makeup effects are actually quite good in this. Mm-hmm. Like, the scene where he peels like the little flap of skin off and pulls the thing out looks pretty real to me. And they do some good things continuity wise. Like, he gets his fingers slammed in a door and he has scabs on his hand for the rest of the movie, which is a good touch that they didn't have to do.
I liked that.
You know, like, it's they paid attention when they made this.
Yeah, no, I like that. I was thinking about that because I literally have a scab on one of my fingers from getting it caught in a door a week ago.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's how life works.
Yeah. But that's something they would just forget about after a scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something we always used to comment about in the Bond films.
Yeah, he doesn't even have black eye or any bruising. Yeah. That's pretty amazing. So he ends up going to Zurich because that's where the bank is. Just like in the later film, which I should stop referring to because this came first. he goes to the bank because he has a bank number. We meet Maester Eamon here from Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Slightly different character this time out. A little more sinister.
Also, like, twice the man he is in Game of Thrones.
Yeah, he, as you're wont to do when you're an older person, he's lost a lot of weight. He also seems to have shrunk by about half his size. But
yeah, no, like, he's like very like the face. Yeah, it's in the face, but like, it's, otherwise, like,
well, I had to look him up. I'm like, wait, that looks like Maester Eamon. I'm like, no, that's not. Yeah, it is. OK. Yeah, he's there at the bank along with the Nazi stooge assistant guy from Raiders of the Lost Ark. He's there, too. Some of this is similar to the movie, the Matt Damon one again. Like, you know, he goes. He has his bank account. They open the safety deposit box for him. You can tell it's the 80s because the safety deposit box just has a bank ledger in it.
I question whether this is really how Swiss banks work, that for signature, all you have to do is provide the account number.
Account number, yeah.
You write the account number, and that's what qualifies as a signature to get into your Swiss bank account. I doubt.
I mean, so we bring this author up many times for various reasons. I'm going to do it again. This reminds me of that scene in
you're going to bring up Dan Brown.
I am going to bring up Dan Brown. The scene of the Da Vinci Code when they go and get the box that has the cryptex in it.
Okay, so listen, I know you don't want to watch the Da Vinci Code again, but I feel like we kind of need to.
Yeah, maybe we do. Yeah. One constant in all the Bourne films and most spy films is that hotel people are terrible when it comes to personal security and information.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can just go to a bank or to a hotel and say, hey, I sprained my hand. I can't write. Can you fill out my hotel lobby card for me? And the guy will do it.
At least in that instance, the guy did know him. Yeah.
Yes, that's true.
Like, that one's not as bad as some movies where they say, oh, I lost my key. Oh, which room?
Yeah.
And I'll just give you the one. Yeah. It's not, at least they didn't do any of that.
My friend so-and-so is staying here. What room are they in again? Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
We get a lot of, I forgot. Please tell me something I should already know in the scene too. But this guy's very helpful. And this is where we first meet Marie, who is very different in this story.
And also where we first hear about Treadstone.
Mm-hmm. Treadstone 71. Movie rule we see come to fruition here. If there's a TV on in a room, it's going to convey some very important information at just the right time.
Mm.
As we're watching Jason Bourne try to figure out who Treadstone is and dealing with an operator that can't help him. And then as soon as he hangs up, he hears a news clip about, or an interview with some guy who will be very important later.
Such a weird interview, too. Like, so he was the guy in charge of security for the guy that got assassinated. And I'm like, how do you feel about this?
Yes. How does it make you feel that the guy you were protecting was assassinated? not ideal interviewing. Donald Moffat, the first of many that guys. I mostly remember him from playing LBJ in The Right Stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But he's been in a ton of things.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I've seen that reporter somewhere, too. But it'd be hard to look him up and figure out who he is. Because there's, as we discussed before, there are a ridiculous number of people in this.
Oh, my God, there are.
And it doesn't help that half the people on IMDb don't have photos.
Yes. I like how the guy who plays the senator in this movie, his IMDb photo is General Riken from Empire Strikes Back.
And the Nazi, his photo is him being a Nazi. The guy from,
was he a Nazi in other things too, or was it from Raiders?
I assume from Raiders, but he could have been a Nazi in other
things. No, it's definitely that. That's the scene when they're.
And Mr. Amon is him being Mr. Amon, but at least that was his last role before he died. So that one makes sense.
Well, according to IMDb, Wolf Collar, the actor, is a German-born character actor who, thanks to his height and blue eyes, was often cast as a Nazi or unsympathetic German characters. So there you go.
So I'm also not 100% sure, because we'll talk about him later, but the one goon that kind of looks a bit like a bald, burly Charles Dance. I'm not 100% sure. I think he's George Lane Cooper, who's credited as Gigantic Man, but I'm not 100% sure on that.
No, because I think Gigantic Man is the other guy, the one that has the Frank Zappa mustache.
That would make sense, because he has a Frank Zappa mustache in his IMDb photo as well.
No, because I looked him up too, because I was trying to figure that out.
So if he's not Gigantic Man, who is he? Because I don't think they ever say his name. Oh, he might say his name when he tells him to kill Marie. But I also like that Wolf Collar's character is named Gold Glasses.
Yes. Or
it's credited as.
Better than Gigantic Man.
He's not the fat man, is he?
No, I think the fat man is the guy that works in the Dry Oppenhauser restaurant.
Oh, that would make sense. Yes. I like how he's the fat man.
Yeah, they have Gigantic Man credited, but they don't have the other guy. And he was in a lot more scenes.
Yeah. And again, the lack of photos. Oh, there's another guy from Indiana Jones here.
Yes, he's the sword guy from Indiana Jones.
Wait, is he the...
Terry Richards.
Is that him?
I think it is.
Because I am looking at, yes, the sword guy from Indiana Jones here, but I didn't realize that was Okay. Do we have a photo of him when he's not being the sword guy?
There's, yes. Yeah, so you go there.
He was also in Empire Strikes Back. It's one of his photos.
He was an uncredited Wampa.
He was in Tomorrow Never Dies as a thug.
Yeah, Carver's thug. He was in Red Sonja, and the picture there is definitely that guy.
Okay.
So his name is Johan in this movie.
Yes. Yeah, no, now I recall him calling him Johan again. Yep. In the scene where he tells him to kill Marie.
Yep.
I was just thinking of him as bald Tywin Lannister the whole movie. He's also his suit is too tight.
Probably for effect.
Yeah. It makes him look bigger.
Yep. So there are one thing I'll say, that there are so many scenes in this where people just shoot people in broad daylight in public and nothing happens. Oh my god,
there are so many people that get shot in this movie.
Like
in the bank lobby, there's
yes!
random bystanders just get mown down.
Gold Glasses guy just pulls out his gun and shoots like three people.
Yeah.
And then he leaves and nobody does anything about it. Yeah, they shoot up a whole bunch of people in this lobby of the bank, and he gets away. We get a whole sequence of him trying to get away from Gold Glasses, because that's the only name we have for him. And he kidnaps Marie, whom he ran into in the hotel lobby just in passing, and uses her kind of as a means of escape. So it's a much more violent way of getting to know this person versus the Matt Damon movie.
Yes.
I should also say Marie is a Canadian economist in this version of the story. She is not.
Yeah.
I think one of the things they could have done if they were going to shorten this into a feature length is they make multiple stops to these locations where they just find out that somebody named Jason Bourne had been here before. Mm-hmm. But they go to this restaurant and the fat man that runs the restaurant is very upset that he's showing up there.
Yes.
It doesn't really advance the plot much.
No, and if they had actually made this into a movie instead of a TV miniseries, that scene would probably not exist.
No, but at some point Marie gets away, goes to I shouldn't say that because we miss another that guy this time.
Yeah, there's another that guy that didn't need to be in this movie.
Another that guy from Blackadder.
Yes!
who's in a wheelchair and in a very unconvincing way. I think they try to make him look like he has had his legs amputated.
Yeah, and
my favorite is there's a scene where he
did not need to be there either.
No, well, other than that, Bourne shoots him in the neck because we find out that there's a person who is a real assassin named Carlos, known as Carlos the Jackal. Calling card apparently is shooting people through the neck, and it's another person who Bourne ends up killing. You know, they run away. And this is when Marie escapes and tries to go yells for help and ends up going right to the Gold Glasses guy and his buddy, who claim to be the police. They go get Bourne. This is when Bourne gets his hand caught in the door or slammed in the door.
Yeah.
And then they send the guy who the overweight Charles Dance guy or the very large Charles Dance guy. Johan, yeah, I guess we said his name was.
I mean, he is overweight, but he's not like.
No, he's not overweight. He's just big. He's a big, big dude.
He's burly, I think, is how I described it in my notes. Yep. And I think that is the best way to describe him.
Yeah, burly. That works.
Burly, bald Charles Dance.
Yeah. Burly, bald Charles Dance is told to go kill Marie, so he decides to go and rape her first. There's more misogyny in this version of the story, I will say.
And plus, you know, he's a goon. It's what goons do.
I guess. I mean, it's really there because they have to set it up so that Bourne can save her.
Yeah.
And that kind of changes her whole feeling on the matter, I guess, with being with Bourne rather than these other goons. I did make a note that Bourne somehow finds, I guess, the only silver Mercedes in Zurich, because that's how he recognizes that's the car.
Yeah, there probably are a couple more in Zurich, I would think.
Yeah. I could have sworn.
But there's no bear.
There is no bear, no. I thought for sure that
any of our listeners actually get that reference from like
they've been listening to this show for a while then.
Yeah. And I'm very sorry. Huh?
Did you think Burly Guy was killed here?
Yeah.
Yeah. Turns out he's not.
Oh, don't forget Help me remember. I have feedback on one of our episodes to talk about at the end.
Oh, okay. Feedback. Yay.
Yes.
Yeah, so Born is fighting the burly guy and is about to get beaten up, and Marie finds the gun in the car and shoots the burly guy multiple times and ends up saving Born. Like I said, I could have sworn the burly guy was dead because he got shot about four times here.
Yeah, I think so. It certainly looked that way. Yeah, because she shot, she keeps shooting him and he flinches when she shoots. So I assume she hits him.
Mm-hmm. We never see him fall, actually, now that I look at it.
No, but I assumed he was shot enough that he would die.
Yeah, but this leads Marie to drive off with him and they go to some hotel somewhere. I can't remember where. It's between Zurich and Paris.
Mm-hmm.
She says she's going to help him, but only briefly. And we all know how that's going to go.
Right.
There is a remarkably cheesy lovemaking scene in this movie that is so awful. And I mean awful, and just in a cringy TV soap opera kind of way.
And like, she's wearing like a bodysuit.
Apparently.
I mean, okay, I guess people can wear whatever they want. It just feels like a weird choice in undergarments.
I think it's
because it's the 80s of TV. But
yes.
It's weird. Like,
it is weird.
Are they not allowed to show midriffs on TV in the 80s?
They might not have been able to. I don't know.
Nah, you've seen.
I've seen midriffs before. I saw Tasha Yar's midriff.
I was going to say. Time, so. Oh, yeah, we discussed that TNG was on the air. Justice had already aired on TV.
That is true. That was a year before this.
Yeah. There's considerably less moose knuckle in this movie than in Justice.
True. Very true.
Yeah, but she's going to stay with him because she doesn't believe he's a killer, and she's going to help him figure out what's going on and solve everything.
Yep. And she volunteers to go to the bank because, again, she is an economist and she's a PhD, actually, in economy or in some kind of economics stuff. They don't really say what, but she knows all these terms, and she recognizes a term at some point about, oh, that means this kind of secure bank thing.
I like the scene where they're looking at the microfiche, too. That's cool.
Oh, yeah. Remember those? Do you remember those? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I remember those. I mean, that's not a thing today, but I certainly do remember them.
Trying to read newspaper front pages in reverse black and white on those big screens. Yeah.
Yeah, no, there was a didn't have to do it much. But yeah, no, there were a couple times when I had like reports for school that I had to look stuff up. Of course, yeah. Kids today have no idea what that is. Nor should they.
No. We're almost to the big cliffhanger of the first part where Marie goes into the bank and we find Burly Guy going in after her, and Bourne's trying to call her on the phone and she's not there anymore.
And then it's such a stressful moment. We get to see the same scene twice. Get to
see the scene, yes.
So, yeah, I guess that's the cliffhanger. We find out that Charles Dance is still alive.
He is.
Except he's not Charles Dance.
No.
We should just call him Discount Charles Dance.
Okay, that works. Discount Charles Dance. Yeah.
Yeah, Discount Charles Dance is still alive. And so now we know that the guy at the bank called him.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Jason Bourne calls the guy back and pretends that he's not actually going to come after all to get
get
Discount Charles Dance to leave.
Yes, because and then they follow the banker guy.
They follow him way too closely.
They're not like, yeah.
There's a couple scenes where they're right behind him. That is not how you follow someone, not discreetly anyway.
Yeah, but Jason Bourne put on his giant 80s glasses, so he was unrecognizable at that point. he wears some giant 80s glasses a few times in this movie.
Yeah.
Oh, and then we find out. So this is one question that I don't think I ever got an answer to, and maybe I missed it. So at one point, Marie calls her friend Peter to get information, and he gives her some information about you know, some stuff that's going on. He works, I guess, in the Canadian banking system of some way. And she calls back again to find out more, and he's been murdered.
Yes.
Like, who killed him?
Excellent question.
And why? Because she immediately thinks that it's the Treadstone people that Bourne's connected to.
Right. Well, and maybe was it Maester Aemon and the traitor?
Maybe, but why would you draw attention to yourself that way?
Don't know.
Or could it just be that it's there to set up like dramatic tension between Marie and Bourne for about two scenes?
That might be too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now we are introduced to all these people in this Treadstone office in New York.
Yep.
And like they get names and everything, and none of this is necessary.
Well, we see four of them at least again once.
Once.
I mean, you've got General Ryken here. You've got Donald Moffat again with his squared off knit tie that he's wearing, which is of the time. Shane Rimmer's here because Shane Rimmer's in everything.
We got the guy from Star Wars.
Yep. And the traitor guy, who's another that guy, although I can't really name anything he's in, but I've definitely seen him before.
Yep.
The old couple have to get names because they own the house. So right. That they're hanging out in.
I guess.
The guy from Star Wars, he must have injured his vocal cords or something at the Battle of Hoth, because the way he's talking through his nose here is kind of annoying.
It's
a choice.
He's trying to sound like a Kennedy.
Maybe.
Like, that's what I figure. Cause it's like, maybe. He's trying to sound like a, it sounds like a fake Kennedy. Like somebody's doing a bad JFK impersonation.
Not as bad as the one from Spy Hard, but.
Nothing is as bad as the anything from Spy Hard.
Donald Moffat's eyebrows really bother me in this movie. What is going on with those eyebrows?
They are quite white.
They are very white.
Bushy, and they stick straight out in his face. And it hadn't bothered me until this moment, and now it does. Thanks, Carl. But no, the guy from Empire Strikes Back is a James Bond connection, because he was also in Octopussy.
Yes.
He's an American general, I assume, at the circus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, you know, of course, again, Shane Rimmer, who was in about half of the Bond movies, is here, too. He's the sub-commander in The Spy Who Loved Me. He was, the enemy has blown up in, You Only Live Twice? Mm-hmm. He's in at least one other one. I don't know who these old people are. They're going to die soon, anyway.
They're old people.
They're old people who own the house.
Yeah. Why do they kill them?
Because they're trying to set up that Bourne did it, which is kind of a plot thread from the Bourne Supremacy, when you think about it, that they used in that movie, the beginning, where they murder a bunch of people and plant a fingerprint that makes them think Bourne was there. I will give them credit that they actually show how they got Bourne's fingerprint this time around, unlike in the Bourne Supremacy. Another area that could have been cut, though, this whole thing with the dress shop.
Yeah, that was weird. And of course, since he's wearing sunglasses, he's incognito.
Yeah, I'm doing a bad accent. Everything about his look in the scene is so 80s. It's hilarious, actually.
Yeah, that leather jacket. Wow.
Well, the leather jacket with that tan sweater and his pleated khaki, gray khaki pants is a look.
And the aviators. That he wears inside.
Yes. Yes. The Canadian government is involved now because they try to get Marie to give up Bourne.
And she won't do it. She's running away. And then, so Bourne is now out to eat with the woman from the dress shop. And she tells him all about
Jason Bourne.
She'll tell him all about Jason Bourne and Carlos. And
I forgot to mention that Randall Tarley is here, too. He's at the bank, or he's at the dress shop as well.
Oh, yeah. Yes, he is.
He comes back later. So we find out that Bourne is a crazy assassin who is trying to apparently
take Carlos's place
and become him by infuriating Carlos and his ego.
Yep.
Although, wait, no. Or do we find that out later? The whole ego thing.
No, I think we find it out here.
Okay. Oh, no. That's what they talk about at the Treadstone house. They talk about how they're trying to drive him nuts. And I'm like, if you're a professional assassin and you have a big ego, you're not going to last very long in that business because you're not supposed to get involved. Yeah. But anyway, we find out that Carlos's network is very insulated. Like people don't know anything unless it's necessary to explain the plot of this movie. But other than that, nobody knows anything else about what's going on.
Yep. And Marie goes back to Jason now.
Yep. As I said in my notes, nothing brings a couple together for a lasting relationship like shared emotional trauma like this, because.
Mm. And we find that they've put a story in the paper that Marie is wanted for murder.
That seems so. They claim that is the signal to try to get Bourne to come in and report. And I'm like, that is not that is not a good message.
Yeah, that could have backfired so badly.
Yeah.
But yeah, now we get the people at the house debating what's going on again.
Mm-hmm. And they leave just in time for.
Yeah, David Abbott leaves just in time for everybody else to get mown down.
Right.
So yeah, we have the traitor guy and Mr. Amon come in and kill them all and yep. Plant Bourne's fingerprint.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like planting Bourne's fingerprint didn't go well. Like, it was poorly done because yep. He then breaks the glass. Like, that could have ended. Yes. And it couldn't get that fingerprint.
Also, I was hoping that somebody would, like, they mentioned later, like, oh, there was only one, the whole place was trashed and these people were killed and we found exactly one fingerprint. And I was like, isn't that a red flag for you people?
You'd think.
But I don't know. I do appreciate they took the time to show that the traitor guy's having a bit of hard time with this whole situation where they're
yes.
shooting these people and, you know.
Yeah, like, maybe he didn't know. Like, you almost get the feeling maybe he didn't even know that that was the plan, was to kill them
maybe.
All.
Maybe, yeah.
But how could he not when they go in there with guns while they're there? I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But Abbott gets away.
Abbott gets away because he went out the back door just in time. We get a very dramatic scene between Bourne and Marie in the car.
Yes.
That is one of those moments where this crosses over into soap opera territory a little bit. But that's okay. She's essentially trying to convince him, like, you think you're an assassin and you're not, and you should try to fix this. And I find the way that the scene turns a bit amusing when he turns around and smiles at her and they run into each other's arms and all that crap. But
right.
So one thing I really like, and I had forgotten about when I watched this, how kind of inverted the story is from the Matt Damon version, where mm-hmm. in the Matt Damon version, you get a guy who doesn't know who he is, and he thinks he's a decent person, and it turns out he's a cold-blooded killer. And this time, you have somebody who all the evidence is pointing to him being a cold-blooded killer, and it turns out he's not at all.
Yeah. I do like that.
And that he's spending the whole time trying to convince himself that he's a bad person and he's not a bad person. And it's just kind of the opposite of what you get with the other story. And I like this, the way this is told. And you know, we'll get to the big reveal about who Bourne is and stuff later. But I do like it.
Mm-hmm. And I really like, for me at least, having never read the book, going into this, not knowing any of that story from the book, I found it really good here in this last in the last hour or so, where, you know, we come to the climax and we reveal everything. I found it fascinating. I really enjoyed it at this point.
No, the last hour or so is probably the best part. I mean, I wonder if I would think the same if I didn't already know the bones of from the Matt Damon
so movie. Like, if we had, you know, gone into this completely blind, you mean?
Having no idea what this is about, mm-hmm. or what it's based on or anything.
I don't know.
Because the stuff before that is, it's not the same story, but it's a similar structure where it's guy doesn't know who he is, finds clues, mm-hmm. government's trying to get him, that sort of thing. And then at the end here, it turns on, it pivots a bit to something a little bit different. We find this woman who picks up the woman, so the lady that he had, Brett, or had lunch with, is picked up by this other woman, and they go off to a church, and they find her, or Bourne finds her killed. I'm trying to remember, because I don't have the sound on, how they connect this with the French general.
They got it through the phone number. They called his house.
That's right. Yeah, so they think this general's involved with Carlos. Should say he sees Carlos leaving the church, and because he looks similar, he walks in a similar way, I guess, to somebody he vaguely remembers from a time before. He yells at him, and then here's where we shoot a bunch of people in the middle of Paris, and nobody cares. like, he even goes back into the church and talks to the priest, and the priest isn't like, I thought I heard gunshots or something. Like, what is going on here?
And then he plays the old insurance scam hit by the car trick on the general.
Yes. Yes, he does.
The general, who the actor gets second billing in this show, but I don't think I've ever seen him in something else.
He was in a bunch of older stuff. Anthony Quayle. Yeah. Lawrence of Arabia and the Guns in
the Okay, Room, so I have seen big, Lawrence of Arabia, but
yeah,
it's been a very long time, and I couldn't tell you any of the actors in Lawrence of Arabia other than Peter O'Toole and Omar Sharif. I mean,
okay, that's fair.
Because yes, contrary to what you may believe, I do sometimes watch movies older than 1980.
Okay. Well, you watched 12 O'Clock High recently, yeah. So yeah.
It's not the only black and white movie we've ever seen. Lawrence of Arabia is not black and white, but that's the
sun. No, it's not. No. So we find out that this guy's wife is a mole for Carlos. And I like the scene where he's, you know, kicking himself because he's like, I was always trying to figure out why this young woman was interested in me, and it never occurred to me that it could be for this. Because Carlos apparently had this guy's son blown up at one point.
And she is Carlos's girlfriend.
Yes.
So, yeah, this is the plot thickens for sure.
Yep. And I like this idea here. Bourne goes and calls Randall Tarley and says, you know, all these other people are dead and you might be next. So if you help me, I'll give you money so you can get away and all this stuff. So he kind of rats him out a little bit. Not before there's yet another shootout in the middle of Paris with no consequences to anybody.
So many.
And Bourne shows up with an amazing 80s camcorder in the scene. I love too. This.
Yes, because he's using it to like stake out the people.
Yeah. It's kind of brilliant, mm-hmm. actually. Yeah, I can zoom in on the rooftops of the buildings and.
Yeah, and I like the drunk guy on the stairs. That's actually a.
Yep.
Or was that at the church? I'm sorry. That might.
No, the drunk guy was at the church. Is this the moment when they get in the car and they drive by and they just shoot at Master Eamon for some reason and then leave? And again, nobody stops them.
Well, it's because
where are the Parisian police?
Well, it's because he dives out of the car and gets him to chase the other car. That's why he did it.
Yeah, I know.
But it's yes. This is like in the shadow of the Eiffel Tower. Yeah, there's like
right.
There's police everywhere for sure.
Not this time.
Yeah, which is how I'm pretty sure this is on location. I mean, it might be a green screen, but I doubt it.
No, I don't think they would have had green screen that good.
Yeah.
And it doesn't look like rear projection
either. They didn't have rear projection that good either.
No, they still don't. Yeah. That's why they do green screen.
Yeah. so they probably paid it probably cost them a fair bit to film this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I wonder now.
I wonder if it tells you what the budget was on this.
I'm checking. Wikipedia doesn't. That's the sort of thing you can only see on IMDb Pro, I think, for IMDb. Wikipedia usually says budgets, but I guess that's only for movies. Yeah, I don't know. Try Googling it, no luck.
Yeah. So anyway, Bourne has arranged a meet with Abbott in the cemetery.
Oh, but first Bourne corners one of the goons. That's where he learns he's not really Bourne.
Oh, that's from Randall Tarley.
Yeah, from Randall Tarley. Yes.
Right. Yeah.
He catches up to Randall Tarley in the subway.
Yeah, and finds out that he's not he looks like him, but he's not the same guy because he's met him.
Yeah. And that was a like big whoa moment for me. I'm like,
Yeah. What?
Yeah.
Well, that's new.
Yeah, exactly. So now, yes, he's going to meet up with Abbott. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the they don't trust him. So they've got the general and the guy who's actually the traitor.
Yep.
Watching over it.
They're there to possibly kill Bourne.
Yeah, but what actually happens is that the traitor kills the general and shoots Abbott.
Yep. Who gets to do a big info dump before he dies.
Yeah.
Now, I will say that in the books, he doesn't get killed.
Ah, okay.
He's injured here, but he doesn't get killed because he's in other stories.
Like, he looks remarkably not dying until the moment that he starts dying. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, he's up and he's walking and he's gesticulating as he's talking. Like, he looks, he's injured, but he doesn't look like he's dying until
right.
he starts dying.
Could be bleeding internally. Who knows?
Yeah, I suppose.
We find out that Bourne was a very good fisherman as a kid and that the paper came and took pictures of him and all that stuff. And he finds out his name is David Webb. Mm-hmm. So the whole idea here was that Bourne was a real assassin and they assumed his identity so that they could get to Carlos.
Yes. And we get some, you know, less than moral dealings with this, because apparently Bourne was actually working for them, but they didn't trust him.
Yes.
So they had him murdered and replaced him with David Webb.
Right. Yes, he was. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's fun.
Yeah. And now they're going back to the general's house because his wife is their only lead to Carlos at this point. But we find out that the general couldn't wait to murder his wife, so she's dead.
And he's about to kill himself, but
right.
Bourne talks him out of it.
Yep. Writes Treadstone 71 on her back in lipstick, and they drop her off at the house, and you get the cheesy, like, far away scream shot from Carlos's house, which is just, it's cheesy.
Very much. But yeah, now we go to another location shoot where we're at this fancy villa.
Mm-hmm. For like 2 minutes. Mm-hmm.
And then we're in New York.
Yep. And this part was, I mean, other than some of the specifics, this part was surprisingly similar to the Matt Damon film, mm-hmm. in that there's a shootout in this.
And the stairwell fight and everything. Yeah.
Yep. And the guy falls through the hole in the middle of the stairs.
Yeah. So he finally gets to confront Carlos in his childhood home, in Bourne's childhood home, mm-hmm. not Carlos's.
Yep. Right.
And yeah, we got the fight. Carlos falls through the hole. Then he crawls away.
We shoot Burly Charles Dance.
Mm-hmm. This time he is dead.
Bourne gets shot a few times here.
Yeah. I wasn't quite. Why did he shoot the chandelier?
I think he thought that Carlos might be under the boxes or hiding under the boxes somewhere.
Like, I guess.
Is my guess.
Yeah. He wasn't.
I want to know where all the moving people came, what or where they went.
As soon as the shooting started, I'm sure they ran.
No, maybe. That's true. That's a good point. Because they were all up in the top floor.
Right. Yeah. And then, yeah, we get the funeral for Abbott. Yeah. And then Bourne can now go and live his life. And he walks mm-hmm. away, and I half expect Moby music, but there isn't any.
There is no Moby in this movie. There's no Moby in Zero.
I don't think Moby was an artist yet at this time.
No, probably not.
Now I don't know. I'm looking. I mean, he could have been.
He's probably very young.
Moby was born in 1965, so he
could. No, he's not as young as I thought. He okay.
could have been in. Yeah, have been recording in this, but I'm guessing his career is later. Years active 1983 to present. So, okay. Yeah, it's possible. Oh. He hadn't made it big yet.
No.
His breakthrough was in 1991 with his single Go. So, no, Moby is not in this movie.
No. So, in around 1988, which is the year this movie was made, Moby moved into a semi-abandoned factory in Stamford, Connecticut that had no bathroom or running water, but the free electricity supply allowed him to work on his music using a 4-track recorder, synthesizer, and drum machine. So he was making music, he just wasn't making any money for
right.
it.
Right. How did I not know that one of Moby's tracks that made the top 10 is the James Bond theme, the Moby's reversion?
Oh, that's not a good version of the Bond theme. Remember, that one has like a lot of sampling of Pierce Brosnan in it.
Oh, it's on the Tomorrow Never Dies soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it has Pierce Brosnan and it has Pierce Brosnan from GoldenEye saying Bond, James Bond.
Many times.
And it has Bond and it has Sean Connery and Goldfinger doing the You Expect Me to Talk, No, I Expect You to Die. Apparently.
Yeah, that's right. It's been a while since I heard it.
I don't think I've ever heard it, but I'm okay with that.
It's not great. I don't. Yeah.
But it made the top 10.
Yeah. So you had feedback. You wanted to talk about some feedback.
So my friend Stuart, who some listeners mm-hmm. may know as my podcast co-host back in the Delta Flyer and Stargate Weekly days, listened to our Bourne Ultimatum podcast episode and sent quite a bit of feedback. Apparently, we annoy him a lot.
Oh, no. Sorry, Stuart.
So Stuart writes, and I apologize, Stuart, for the fact that, you know, this is now, you know, several months later, but this is the first time we've recorded since you sent this feedback. Stuart writes, in your episode about the Bourne Ultimatum, one of you said that Nikki broke her phone to leave a trail. That's not what she was doing. She was tearing it to pieces to ensure that it couldn't be tracked. She works for the CIA, so who knows what sneaky stuff is in that phone.
Okay, fair point.
As for global keyword surveillance in 2007, Echelon was established in 1971, initially to spy on Soviet military and government comms. It was a joint UK-US program that continued to grow and expand and eventually included the Five Eyes. EYES, mm-hmm. not, you know, the letter, okay. I guess. US and UK have a long history of cooperation in espionage, so while the question of could they scrape every conversation is valid, the idea that the CIA have a London station that gets to tap into the CCTV network makes sense.
Okay, good. Because that was something I was not sure about.
I still wonder if they could have scraped every spoken location.
No, yeah. And to be fair, Stuart acknowledges that that is still up in the air.
one of you expressed confusion regarding Desch. I thought the German guy was the last remaining Treadstone agent. Treadstone was the name given to the specific group of people that underwent the specific training and mental programming that Jason Bourne and his contemporaries had. Blackbriar was the umbrella name for all the CIA. I think we did eventually talk about this.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
Aaron Cross was a member of another different program, the name of which I've forgotten.
Outcome.
Yes. And he in turn was hunted. Okay, we talked about this in our Bourne Legacy episode, which is why. Okay, so Stuart and I, and you'll be happy to know, Stuart, that we came to this discussion on our own when we were talking about Bourne Legacy without having seen your feedback. So the plot, yes, the rest of this is telling us that the plot of Bourne Legacy continues. So yes, this part we did actually do. Yeah. So thank you, Stuart, but we were with you just one movie ahead. So anyway, yes, thank you for the feedback, Stuart, and listeners, please send us feedback if you want to.
We're still on Twitter at Podspiel.
Yes.
PodSpiel. We have our spielpodcast@gmail.com email address, which I really should check again because it's been a while.
So theoretically, you can send us feedback.
Yes.
You can also find us individually if we don't respond from the License to Spiel accounts, which is entirely likely. You can find us individually. I am on Twitter at Tyrannicus. That's TYRANICUS.
Yes, and I am at Listening to Film. We are both at Blue Sky and Mastodon as well.
With the same name.
I'm a little more guilty of not checking those as often, but I promise I will get to that. You can also find this episode and all episodes in our back catalog at our website, licensedtospiel.com. Yeah, for now, this is the end of
The end of Jason Bourne.
Jason Bourne will return.